A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He's been living with post-cholecystectomy complications, and the thing that bothers him most is post-meal bloating, especially after fat. He's tried controlling fat intake, but he makes an interesting point. When you have to think about every meal as a nutritional profile, the spontaneity of food, the joy of it, just evaporates. So he's more interested in supplements taken with meals, because even though that's also less spontaneous, it at least widens what you can eat without the aftermath. But here's the rub. He's skeptical of the two things we've discussed before. Ox bile and digestive enzymes. Ox bile, weak evidence. Enzymes, more targeted at pancreatic stuff, not specific to gallbladder removal. His actual question is, are there any alternative interventions, supplements, medicines, anything worth keeping on the radar beyond what we've already covered? Because as things stand, it's a fairly weak argument for a situation that disables a lot of people.
He's right to be skeptical of the cocktail approach. Just throwing ox bile and enzymes at the problem because they're the two things people talk about in forums, that's not medicine, that's alchemy with slightly better branding.
Kitchen sink gastroenterology.
Exactly the phrase I was reaching for. So let's do what he's actually asking. Let's map the terrain beyond the usual suspects. And I want to start by naming something that most patients never hear about, which is genuinely maddening because it's been around for decades and the evidence base is solid.
Don't say bile acid binders.
I'm absolutely saying bile acid binders. But not just saying it. I want to explain why they're relevant to bloating specifically, because that's the connection most doctors don't make for patients. When your gallbladder is gone, bile doesn't get stored and released in pulses anymore. It just drips continuously from the liver into the small intestine. That constant drip does two things. One, it irritates the intestinal lining. That's the gastritis and inflammation piece. But two, and this is the part that connects directly to bloating, bile acids in the wrong place at the wrong time alter the gut microbiome and disrupt motility. They slow things down in some segments, speed things up in others, and the net effect is gas production and distension that has nothing to do with how much fat you ate.
The bloating isn't just undigested fat fermenting. It's bile itself causing chaos.
And if bile is the agent of chaos, binding it up makes intuitive sense. Cholestyramine, brand name Questrin, is a bile acid sequestrant. It's a powder you mix with water, and it literally binds to bile acids in the intestines so they can't wreak havoc. It's been used for decades for bile acid diarrhea, which is a common post-cholecystectomy problem. But the thing that doesn't get talked about enough is that patients on cholestyramine often report their bloating improves dramatically, even when diarrhea wasn't their primary complaint.
This is an off-label adjacent use of something already approved.
It's not even off-label, really. Bile acid malabsorption is a recognized consequence of cholecystectomy, and cholestyramine is the first-line treatment for bile acid malabsorption. The gap is that most physicians only think to prescribe it when the patient reports watery diarrhea multiple times a day. If the patient's main complaint is bloating, distension, and discomfort,
they get told to eat less fat and maybe try a probiotic.
And look, cholestyramine isn't a perfect drug. It's a gritty powder that tastes like orange-flavored regret. It can interfere with absorption of fat-soluble vitamins and other medications if you don't time it right. Some people get constipated. But for the bloating-dominant post-cholecystectomy patient, it's something that should be in the conversation way earlier than it typically is.
What's the dosing reality? Because I feel like that's where these things live or die in actual human use.
The tricky part is that it's highly individual. Standard starting dose is usually one packet, 4 grams, once or twice a day, but the therapeutic window for the post-cholecystectomy bloating patient might be much lower. Some people do brilliantly on half a packet before their largest meal. Others need a full packet twice a day. The art is in the titration, and that's where the medical system fails, because titration requires follow-up and adjustment and actually listening to the patient.
Which is three things. The 7-minute gastroenterology consult doesn't accommodate.
That's the structural problem underneath all of this. But to stay on supplements and interventions, let's talk about something else that's emerging. There's a peptide called FGF19, fibroblast growth factor 19. This is the hormone that normally gets released when bile acids reach the ileum, and it signals the liver to reduce bile acid synthesis. It's part of the negative feedback loop. After cholecystectomy, that loop is dysregulated. Bile acid synthesis goes up, FGF19 levels drop. Researchers have been looking at FGF19 analogs as a therapeutic approach, essentially restoring the feedback signal pharmacologically.
Instead of binding the excess bile, you're telling the liver to make less of it in the first place.
That's the idea. There's a drug called aldafermin, which is an engineered FGF19 analog that's been through phase 2 trials for non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. It didn't hit its primary endpoint for NASH, but the mechanism is directly relevant to what we're talking about. It suppresses bile acid synthesis. For post-cholecystectomy patients with bile acid diarrhea, this is being explored. There was a study out of the University of Gothenburg a few years back that showed FGF19 administration normalized bile acid synthesis in cholecystectomized patients.
Where is this on the pipeline timeline? Are we talking next year or next decade?
Realistically, next decade for an approved indication. The NASH space absorbed most of the development energy, and when those trials disappointed, a lot of the funding dried up. But there are smaller biotechs still working on bile acid modulation. The science is sound. The commercial path is just messy.
That's the pipeline. What about things someone could actually get their hands on now, without a prescription? You mentioned probiotics earlier with a certain tone.
I have a whole taxonomy of tones for probiotics.
Of course you do.
Here's the thing about probiotics and post-cholecystectomy bloating. Most people grab a generic lactobacillus off the shelf and hope for the best, and that's almost certainly useless. But there are specific strains that have been studied in the context of bile acid metabolism and bloating. The one I find most interesting is Bifidobacterium infantis, now reclassified as Bifidobacterium longum subspecies infantis. This strain has been shown in several studies to reduce bloating and abdominal distension in functional bowel disorders. The mechanism isn't fully worked out, but it appears to have anti-inflammatory effects on the gut mucosa and may influence bile acid deconjugation.
Bile acid deconjugation being the process by which gut bacteria modify bile acids and make them more or less irritating?
Primary bile acids get deconjugated and dehydroxylated by gut bacteria into secondary bile acids, which are more hydrophobic and more irritating to the intestinal lining. If you can shift the bacterial populations toward those that produce less toxic secondary bile acids, you might reduce symptoms. Some strains of Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium do exactly that. But the key word is some. The strain specificity matters enormously, and most commercial probiotics don't disclose strain-level information.
The probiotic aisle is a lottery where 90% of the tickets lose, and the remaining 10% might help. But you can't read the fine print well enough to know which is which.
That's the probiotic aisle perfectly described. But there's one more supplement category that deserves attention, and it's one that almost nobody talks about in the gallbladder community. If part of the bloating problem is that the constant bile drip has disrupted normal intestinal motility, slowed things down in the small bowel, created areas of stasis where bacteria overgrow and produce gas, then a prokinetic agent could theoretically help by restoring more normal movement patterns. The most studied natural prokinetic is ginger, and there's actually decent evidence for ginger in functional dyspepsia and bloating. A meta-analysis published a few years ago in the World Journal of Gastroenterology looked at 5 randomized controlled trials and found ginger significantly accelerated gastric emptying and reduced dyspeptic symptoms.
What dose are we talking about?
The studies typically use 1 to 1.2 grams of ginger powder before meals. That's about half a teaspoon. The mechanism is partly serotonergic. Ginger acts on 5-HT3 and 5-HT4 receptors, which are involved in gut motility. It also has anti-inflammatory effects, and unlike a lot of supplements, it's cheap, widely available, and has a good safety profile.
It's food, which makes the spontaneity argument interesting. You're not taking a pill, you're adding ginger to your cooking or having ginger tea.
Which is psychologically different, and that matters. The prompt raised this really thoughtful point about how the joy of food disappears when every meal becomes a calculation. Ginger integrates more naturally into food culture than, say, mixing a packet of orange grit into water before dinner.
Though I will say, the clostramine orange grit ritual has its own kind of meditative quality if you squint hard enough, like a very unpleasant tea ceremony.
The tea ceremony of resignation.
We've got bile acid binders, FGF-19, analogs in the pipeline, strain-specific probiotics, and ginger as a prokinetic. What about the enzymatic angle from a different direction? He mentioned digestive enzymes being too pancreatic-focused. Is there anything that targets fat digestion more specifically in a way that compensates for the missing gallbladder function?
There's an interesting nuance here that gets lost in most discussions. The gallbladder's job isn't just to store bile, it's to concentrate it. Gallbladder bile is 5 to 10 times more concentrated than hepatic bile. When you eat a fatty meal, the gallbladder contracts and releases this concentrated bile bolus, which gives you a high concentration of bile acids right at the point where fat globules need to be emulsified. After cholecystectomy, you still get bile, but it's dilute hepatic bile trickling in continuously. The concentration never spikes at mealtime.
It's not absence of bile, it's absence of the concentration surge.
And that suggests a different approach. Instead of adding more bile acids, which is what ox bile supplements do, what if you could enhance the emulsification of fats through other mechanisms? This is where something like lecithin becomes interesting. Lecithin is a phospholipid that acts as a natural emulsifier. It's a major component of bile itself. About 90% of biliary phospholipids are phosphatidylcholine, which is the main component of lecithin. There's a hypothesis, not well proven but mechanistically plausible, that supplementing with lecithin could partially compensate for the reduced emulsification capacity by providing additional phospholipids to help break down fat droplets.
How does the evidence look on that?
There are a few small studies. One Italian study from the early 2000s looked at a combination of lecithin and silymarin, milk thistle, in post-cholecystectomy patients and found improvements in dyspeptic symptoms. But it was small, unblinded, and the combination makes it impossible to attribute effects to either component. The mechanistic case is reasonable. The clinical evidence is thin. It's in the might help, probably won't hurt, don't bet your quality of life on it category.
Which is a large and depressing category in this space.
It's the largest category in this space. But I want to circle back to something the prompt touched on that I think is more important than any single supplement. He mentioned dysbiosis and inflammation from the constant bile drip. This is the part where the research is exciting and underappreciated. When bile acids continuously enter the small intestine, instead of being released in meal-triggered pulses, the microbial ecosystem changes. The bacteria that thrive in the presence of bile acids, and some species are remarkably bile-tolerant, start to dominate. These bacteria have enzymes called bile salt hydrolases that deconjugate bile acids. The resulting unconjugated bile acids are more hydrophobic, more detergent-like, and more damaging to the intestinal epithelium. They increase intestinal permeability. They trigger low-grade inflammation. And that inflammation itself impairs motility and promotes gas production. It's a vicious cycle.
The bile drip creates a dysbiotic microbiome. The dysbiotic microbiome makes the bile more toxic. The more toxic bile causes more inflammation. The inflammation worsens the bloating, and round we go.
That's the cycle. And breaking it at any point could theoretically help. Bile acid binders break it at the top by removing the excess bile acids before bacteria can modify them. Probiotics with specific strains might break it in the middle by shifting the bacterial populations toward less harmful bile acid metabolism. Prokinetics break it at the bottom by reducing stasis so bacteria don't have as much time to overgrow and metabolize bile acids. And anti-inflammatory approaches. This is where things get really interesting. Could break the cycle by reducing the intestinal inflammation that drives the whole process.
What kind of anti-inflammatory approaches?
There's a compound called curcumin, from turmeric, that has impressive data for gut inflammation. Not the vague wellness blog data, actual randomized controlled trials. A systematic review in Nutrients in 2023 looked at curcumin for functional gastrointestinal disorders and found significant improvements in bloating scores. The mechanism is multi-target. It inhibits NF-kappa B, reduces pro-inflammatory cytokines, and has direct effects on the gut barrier.
Curcumin absorption is notoriously terrible.
That's the catch. Standard curcumin has bioavailability of maybe 1%. You need a formulation with enhanced absorption, typically combined with piperine from black pepper or using a liposomal or nanoparticle delivery system. The studies that show benefit almost all use these enhanced formulations. The turmeric powder in your spice rack isn't going to do it.
The supplement industry has once again taken something that works under specific conditions and flooded the market with versions that don't meet those conditions.
This is the supplement industry's core competency. But there's another anti-inflammatory angle that's even more directly relevant to the bile acid problem. Omega-3 fatty acids, specifically EPA and DHA from fish oil, have been shown to reduce bile acid synthesis and alter the bile acid pool composition in a less toxic direction. There was a fascinating study in the Journal of Lipid Research that found omega-3 supplementation reduced the hydrophobicity of the bile acid pool in humans. Less hydrophobic bile acids mean less intestinal irritation.
Fish oil isn't just for hearts and brains. It's potentially modifying bile chemistry.
And the dose matters. The studies that show effects on bile acid composition typically use 2 to 4 grams of EPA and DHA per day, which is higher than what most people take for general health. At those doses, you also get the systemic anti-inflammatory effects, which might help with the inflammatory component of post-cholecystectomy bloating.
Taking 4 grams of fish oil with a fatty meal when you already have trouble digesting fat, I see a potential problem.
You're right to flag that. High-dose fish oil can cause bloating and GI upset on its own, especially in people with fat malabsorption. You'd want to start low and titrate up slowly, and use an enteric-coated formulation to reduce upper GI side effects. It's not a first-line thing. It's in the consider if other approaches have failed, and you're working with someone who knows what they're doing. Category.
Which is, I think, a useful way to tier these things. We've got the should-be-offered-to-everyone tier. That's cholesteramine or other bile acid binders. We've got the low-risk, reasonable evidence, try-it-and-see tier. Ginger, specific probiotics, maybe lecithin. We've got the pipeline, check back in 5 years, tier, FGF-19 analogs. And then the mechanistically interesting, but use with caution, tier high-dose fish oil, curcumin.
That's a good framework. And I'd add one more thing to the try-it-and-see tier that's so obvious it almost feels silly to mention, but the evidence for it in functional bloating is actually solid. Enteric-coated peppermint oil. It's a smooth muscle relaxant. It reduces intestinal spasms. It has carminative effects. It helps gas move through rather than getting trapped. There are multiple randomized controlled trials showing it reduces bloating and abdominal distension in irritable bowel syndrome, and the mechanisms would apply to post-cholecystectomy bloating as well. The key is enteric coating because if the peppermint oil releases in the stomach, you get heartburn, and that's not helping anyone.
The menthol burp of regret.
A distinct and memorable experience. But with proper enteric coating, it releases in the small intestine where you want it. Typical dose is 0.2 to 0.4 milliliters of peppermint oil 3 times a day. It's available over the counter. It's cheap. The side effect profile is excellent as long as you use the enteric coated form.
Between ginger, peppermint oil, and a thoughtful probiotic, someone could assemble a fairly reasonable over-the-counter protocol without touching ox bile or generic digestive enzymes.
I think that's the real answer to the question he's asking. The ox bile and enzyme cocktail is what people default to because those are the words that show up in gallbladder forums. But the physiology suggests a completely different approach. Target the bile acid dysregulation, the dysmotility, the dysbiosis, and the inflammation. Those are the 4 pillars. And different interventions hit different pillars.
Let's map it that way. Bile acid dysregulation, cholesteramine, FGF-19, analogs in the future, omega-3s at high dose, dysmotility, ginger, peppermint oil, possibly other prokinetics, dysbiosis, strain-specific probiotics, and actually cholesteramine again, because reducing excess bile acids changes the microbial playing field. Inflammation. Curcumin, omega-3s, and again the bile acid binders, because less toxic bile means less inflammation.
You can see how cholesteramine sits at the center of this Venn diagram. It hits 3 of the 4 pillars directly. That's why it's so frustrating that it's underprescribed.
What's the actual barrier? Is it physician ignorance, or is there something else?
It's partly that cholesteramine is an old generic drug. No one's sending sales reps to gastroenterology offices to talk about Questron. It's partly that the clinical trials, specifically for post-cholecystectomy bloating, haven't been done. The evidence is extrapolated from bile acid diarrhea studies and clinical experience. And it's partly that bloating is, frankly, not taken seriously as a symptom. It's viewed as a nuisance, not a legitimate therapeutic target. You tell your doctor you're bloated after meals, they say eat smaller meals and move on.
Have you tried not eating?
Whereas if you say you have watery diarrhea 8 times a day, they reach for the prescription pad. The severity hierarchy of GI symptoms is completely disconnected from actual quality of life impact. Bloating can be socially disabling. It can affect what you wear, where you go, how long you stay. It's not minor.
That connects back to his point about spontaneity. When you don't know if a meal is going to leave you distended and uncomfortable for the next 6 hours, you stop accepting dinner invitations, you pre-eat before social events, you develop a whole set of compensatory behaviors that shrink your life.
The tragedy is that many of these patients have been told there's nothing that can be done. You had your gallbladder out, this is just how it is now. That's not true. The interventions exist. They're not perfect, they're not 100% effective, but there's a whole ladder of things to try, and most patients never get past the first rung.
Let's give the ladder. If someone's listening and they're in this situation, what's the conversation they should have with their doctor?
First rung, try the simple, low-risk things. Ginger before meals. Enteric-coated peppermint oil. A probiotic with a specific studied strain like Bifidobacterium longum subspecies infantis. Give each one a proper trial, at least 4 weeks, because gut adaptation takes time.
Not all at once, I assume.
No, one at a time, so you know what's doing what. If those don't help, second rung, ask about a bile acid binder. Colestramine is the most studied, but there's also colesevelum and colestipol. Colesevelum comes as a tablet rather than a powder, which some people find more tolerable. Start at a low dose, titrate up slowly, and take it at least an hour apart from other medications.
If that doesn't work?
Third rung, consider a more comprehensive workup. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO, is more common in post-cholecystectomy patients because the altered bile flow disrupts the normal antimicrobial effects of bile acids. If SIBO is present, treating it with rifaximin or other agents might resolve the bloating. There's also the possibility of concurrent conditions like exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, which can be tested for with fecal elastase.
The fourth rung is where we get into the pipeline stuff and the more experimental approaches.
And honestly, by the time someone's at the fourth rung, they probably need to be seen at an academic motility center or a specialized gastroenterology practice. This is not something a primary care physician is going to navigate. But the first two rungs are absolutely doable in primary care, and they could help a substantial number of people.
There's something almost philosophical in his prompt that I want to come back to. The loss of spontaneity. The idea that when food becomes a calculation, something essential about the experience of eating is lost. And he's right. Food is cultural, social, emotional. It's not just fuel. When every meal requires premeditation and risk assessment, you've lost something that supplements can't fully restore.
That's the part that doesn't show up in the clinical trials. Quality of life questionnaires try to capture it, but they don't really. The question, can you eat a meal without planning ahead, isn't on the standard GI symptom scales. And yet it's probably the most important outcome for a lot of patients.
If you could take a pill that eliminated the bloating, but you still had to plan everything, versus a different approach that let you be spontaneous, but had more side effects, I think a lot of people would take the spontaneity.
That's why the conversation has to be individualized. There's no algorithm that tells you which trade-offs a particular patient is willing to make. The job of the clinician is to lay out the options honestly. Here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here are the risks and benefits, and let the patient decide what matters most to them.
Which is a radical departure from eat less fat. Next patient.
But it's also just good medicine.
Before we wrap, I want to ask about one more thing that's been percolating in the background. You mentioned SIBO. Is there a case to be made that post-cholecystectomy bloating is, in a substantial number of cases, actually undiagnosed SIBO?
There's absolutely a case for that. The altered bile flow after cholecystectomy reduces the antimicrobial activity of bile acids in the small intestine. Bile acids normally help keep bacterial populations in check. When that mechanism is impaired, bacteria can overgrow. Studies have found SIBO prevalence in post-cholecystectomy patients ranging from 30 to 50% depending on the diagnostic method used. That's enormous.
SIBO is treatable.
SIBO is treatable. Rifaximin is the mainstay, sometimes with neomycin if methane dominant. The challenge is that SIBO recurrence rates are high, especially if the underlying condition, in this case the altered biophysiology, isn't addressed. So you might treat the SIBO and feel great for 3 months, and then it comes back. That's where combining SIBO treatment with ongoing bile acid management becomes important.
Which brings us back to cholesteramine again.
It does keep coming back to cholesteramine. But I want to be clear, I'm not saying cholesteramine is the answer for everyone. Some people can't tolerate it. Some people get constipated to the point where it's not worth it. Some people find the texture so off-putting that they can't be compliant. But it should be offered. It should be discussed. And right now, for most post-cholecystectomy patients with bloating, it's not even mentioned.
The gap between what the evidence supports and what actually happens in clinical practice is more of a chasm than a gap.
That chasm is filled with people suffering unnecessarily, trying supplement cocktails they read about on forums, spending money on things that don't work, and being told by their doctors that this is just their new normal.
To answer the question directly, yes, there are alternatives beyond ox bile and digestive enzymes. Several of them. Some are available now, some are in the pipeline, and the most important one is a 50-year-old drug that most patients have never heard of.
That's the summary. And I'd add, if you're a post-cholecystectomy patient dealing with bloating, don't accept, that's just how it is. Push for a real workup. Ask about bile acid binders. Try the evidence-supported supplements systematically. And if your doctor won't engage with any of this, find one who will.
The spontaneity of food might not be fully recoverable, but it's worth fighting for.
It absolutely is.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, the average daily caloric intake in rural Nepal was approximately 2,100 kilocalories per person, which converts to roughly 8.8 megajoules, or enough energy, if harnessed perfectly, to power a 60-watt incandescent light bulb for about 41 hours. The diet was predominantly dindo, a thick porridge made from millet or buckwheat flour, consumed with gundruk, a fermented leafy green that provided nearly all dietary vitamin C during winter months when fresh produce was unavailable.
I don't know what to do with the light bulb conversion, but I respect the commitment to it.
Dindo and gundruk. The meal that powered a nation through geopolitics.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you got something out of this one, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.